Hello, and welcome to This Week in the Ancient Near East, the podcast that takes archaeology exactly as seriously as it deserves. I'm Alex Jaffe, director of the Bob and Ray Institute of Archaeology at the University of Southern North Dakota at Hoople. It appears, however, that I am joined by two real academics from actual institutions, Professor J.P. Dussel of the University of Tennessee and Professor Rachel Hallett of the State University of New York at Purchase. We're coming to you from the Tommy Westfall School of Medicine here on the beautiful Hoople campus. Today we're talking about a cache of over 300 Roman surgical instruments from the site of Alianoi, about 17 miles from Pergamon in southwest Turkey. Scalpels, needles, probes, forceps, and other tools indicate a variety of surgical procedures, from cataracts to hemorrhoids, although hopefully not at the same time. The instruments raise all sorts of questions regarding the procedures themselves, which seem both painful and unsanitary, but also the organization and economics of medicine. This small site was also noted for its hot springs. So was it an early HMO or group practice, a specialized Mayo Clinic-style hospital, or something else? Who were the patients, and moreover, what went on medically in areas far away from such clinics? Who did the doctoring? Shamans? Barbers? Tailors? It's hard to say, but it doesn't sound promising. Overall, these Roman doctors seem to have known quite a bit. Too bad they didn't know about germs. Okay, well, should we do a lightning round?
Yes.
Really, why not?
Let's do a lightning round.
Okay. Apropos, as always, what is your favorite TV doctor or hospital?
Oh. Wow.
Pretty thought-provoking, actually.
Yeah,
it is. I haven't.
And watched... why? I mean, if you can...
Yeah, I haven't watched
we need to fill up in an hour.
Kinds of shows in so long.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I was a big ER fan.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah, ER was good.
Yeah.
And, phew.
I think I learned most of my TV medical knowledge from MASH.
Oh, yeah, MASH. Yeah. That was... There you go. Good job, Rachel.
Well, that obviously dates us.
Right.
Although I think, you know, Dr. Kildare would be.
Well, I was going to avoid mentioning Dr. Kildare. Alex, your response?
Oh, well, I literally have a very long list.
Yeah, no, don't want the list.
I'll offer.
I know Quincy's going to be high on that list.
No, I never watched Quincy. And Dr. McCoy has to sit.
Oh, that's separate. Yeah.
At the pinnacle of 24th century medical practice.
Grubbs was good too.
Mm.
Never watched it.
I never got into it. Yeah. Oh, okay. General Hospital, circa the 1960s.
Wow, right. There's right. General Luke and Laura.
Right, exactly.
Right.
All right. I'll just offer two. Yes. One is St. Elsewhere.
Oh yeah, that was a classic.
Because I was in medical school at the time and
hold it, what?
No, you can't say it that way.
Well, I was associated with the medical school at the time.
There you go.
Unless you and were, all of the characters
unless you were one
very...
of those patient types, like going in and getting your assignment and presenting.
Right, like Kramer.
Right.
How come I have double syphilis? but the other one that I always come back to.
Yeah.
Dr. Joe Early from Rampart General Hospital in emergency.
Oh.
Oh, I never liked that.
Because he and Dixie McCall, his faithful nurse. Why are you shaking your head? The great Bobby Troop and Julie London.
I never emergency was a very It was cacophonic. It was a cacophony. It's just like the opening, the thing was, it was just loud and brash and
much.
That's what I liked about it. It
Yeah, I didn't.
completely formed my vision of Los Angeles in the 1970s. And also medical practice. You just pump somebody full of Ringer's lactate, and that's going to stabilize them. Okay, well,
All right.
I don't mean to go do all Dr. Leo Spaceman here. But
Well, shall we go back in time?
let's go back in
At
time.
the Wayback Machine.
Geez, what's the date of this
I
site?
think they were quite cagey about it. They,
they were, but I think
I
it.
want to say second, third century CE. Is that
Yeah.
was right?
Yeah. Somewhere I wrote down 200 CE, so that's exactly about.
Right, said second, third century.
Right.
It's right in the middle, right on the cusp.
Exactly, because I, yeah,
Yeah.
okay. And
So where is the site of Alianoy?
it's in southwestern Turkey. It's north of Pergamon.
okay.
Just, I think one of the articles said 17 miles north of Pergamon.
A hop, skip, and a jump
Yes.
from Pergamon and its giant altars.
Yeah.
Right.
And well, why is it interesting? Possibly because of the find of a cache, we call it a cache, of surgical instruments.
A murder. I think surgical instruments are counted in murders.
They should be. Yeah, so cache of surgical Roman period surgical instruments at the site, which also has is known for and was known for its baths, like a spa.
Like the Magic Mountain, without the mountain or the magic. Scalpels, needles, probes, forceps, drills, all sorts of little variations. A room in the back for the serious surgery, a room in the front where
I suspect that room in the back. I suspect it was in the back so that people couldn't hear the cries of anguish.
Right. Yeah, and the bodies can be carried out without the people in the front seeing them.
Right.
Yeah. It would have been good if I could have found a site plan or a, plan at least of these rooms, but I couldn't.
There's an article in Turkish, but I couldn't find it.
Yeah, me either. Yeah.
But there was lots of surgery going on and lots of germs floating around.
Hadn't thought of that, but yes.
But the article said that the instruments themselves were indicative of doing eye operations, hemorrhoid operations, bladder operations, suturing of wounds. Hopefully
Skull
not,
drilling.
not all at the same time with the same instruments.
Yeah. You left out kidney stone operations.
Right.
Oh, I
Well,
guess.
there was the removal of, or the crushing. They used the word crushing of stones,
Yeah.
and that sounded as unappealing an idea as one could possibly conjure up. Kidney stones, gallstones, so stones in the gallbladder, the bladder, or the kidney,
Yeah.
and some kind of tool to crush them. And I just can't even imagine how that went. I don't want to imagine.
Right. Without anesthesia.
Well, they didn't mention
Well,
that, but
they
there
didn't
have,
mention that.
but they
And that
have to have
raises a
some.
very interesting question.
Well, I'm sure it's been covered in great detail,
Right.
because I'm sure there's a lot of medical, medical
Yeah.
information on the Roman period, but there had to have been some kind of
Right. There had to have been something.
anesthetic. I
That's
mean, they knew
so.
about opium,
Right. Good point.
right? Opium's been floating around for a very long time. We now know in greater quantities. And we just covered the Philistine use of some psychotropics. So I'm sure they had something.
Yeah, that's true. And we've talked about various drugs over the years of this podcast at
Right.
various points.
Well, it's funny because we have talked a lot about drugs because there's been a lot of recent research on it.
Yeah.
And I've brought it up with my students a lot, who of course have made their own assumptions about why I'm bringing it up. But I, as I explained to them, the reason why I'm bringing it up is because just like color or smell or any other senses, we were always thinking, not thinking, we weren't thinking necessarily, but I think we're always teaching all of this material in a sort of sanitized way. And, you know, now we talk about color routinely and how these sites were, you know, quite garish in color and all that kind of thing. But if they were using drugs on a routine, regular basis, that I think that really systematic, or rather, you know, significantly changes our understanding of the period. Yeah. Not that they were all high all the time, but that there were certain places where they did get high. And there were certain times when they did use all sorts of medicinal plants, but also psychotropics, and that that was part of their landscape. And we need to sort of appreciate that because it, you know, it changes, it makes it a much less sterile or sanitized kind of society.
That's true. I think those are valid points. Still, I don't want to think about cataract surgery, for instance.
Yeah, looking at these instruments, which I assume all of these are in bronze.
Yeah.
I assume.
Yeah, and they're looking a little bit worse for the wear.
Right.
As any of us would be after 2,000 years of...
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be probed by any of these. And I wouldn't want any internal stones crushed. And I certainly wouldn't want any eye surgery.
Right, right. No, it's all very disturbing when you think of it that way.
Right. We've taken care of your hemorrhoids. Now we're gonna just move on to your cataracts.
Right. Right. But it also does bring up the issue of all of these people floating around the landscape complaining about, you know, kidney stones and I can't see everything's cloudy. And, you know, it really brings to fore the whole aging process. And again, a less sanitized society that right. people are, you know, people are dragging themselves around. And then eventually, because I don't think it would be a first choice, like, oh, I've got a kidney stone. There's a doctor. I'm going to have him, you know, crush it with right. some tool going in some orifice. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, right? So, like, but clearly it's being done because, oh, that's another interesting thing about this. So the name of the site, does anyone want to take a
name? Try to pronounce it.
Illinois?
Illinois.
Okay, fine. Illinois. It was a small place. It was a small settlement. Mm-hmm. And the number of tools, instruments found, 348, is larger than the accumulated assemblages found at Pompeii and Herculaneum combined.
Yeah.
So that also, to me, raised a really interesting issue, which is obviously medicine is being practiced at a wide assortment of sites, small sites, large sites. And maybe this site was small, but it also had baths, hot springs, which might have attracted more people. So maybe it was a specialized or had a specialty.
Well, wasn't there a gladiatorial school nearby? And there was some suggestion that it might be an HMO for gladiators.
Well, the site with the gladiators was Pergamon. So yeah. It's not right. that close. I mean, right. It's 17 miles. If you got a kidney stone, I'm pretty sure you're not going to make it.
Right.
You're going to be on the side of the road at some point.
But there was a suggestion that because Galen, yeah. So right. He didn't actually mention any sort of medical. He mentioned the baths, but he was practicing his medicine right in Pergamon next door. So
right, but it wasn't exactly next door. And one of the articles pointed out that even though there's interpretation that this was a place for sewing up gladiators, the likelihood of that is not exactly, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe it was just like the Mayo Clinic.
Well, that's what I think. I think, and that's what was pointed out in some of these short articles, which actually these are all pieces that appeared in various popular presses. There was no real specific scholarly article on this. But the association with the baths, I think, is a good one for speculating that this was, some kind of Mayo Clinic.
Yeah, and there were also two inscriptions to Asclepius, in terms of, you know, god of healing, so god of medicine. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say that that it seems like that this might have been a very, not exactly completely specialized, but that because of the hot baths and or the baths and the hot springs, that people went there for their health in general, and that sort of, if I can, if I could say, bled over into a, larger availability of medical practices, the medical arts.
And I want to come back to something you said a minute ago, which is, it gives us insight into aging, because like if you're you have to be in your 60s before cataracts are worth dealing with, at least today. So, people aren't all dying in their 40s. There's at least certain
Not the
old
years,
people.
it's the miles.
It's the miles. Right. One thing that I don't know, this kind of fascinated me. So there must be some sort, I don't know enough about the history of medicine. I don't know anything about the history of medicine, but there must be some sort of continuum from Roman medicine, surgery to Western European Middle Ages to today, because how do you recognize what these tools are for unless you have similarly shaped tools in recent or modern times? So that I was speculating.
Well, there's a line that goes from Greek medicine, which is the beginning of empirical rational observational kind of systematic anatomically based medicine through the Greeks, then through which gets repeated and copied in Islamic medicine and elaborated a little bit, and then gets rediscovered or retranslated in European medicine,
Or revivified.
revivified. And leaving aside completely, let's say the tradition of Chinese medicine, about which is equally long or longer and continuous, about which I know nothing, but which leads to Western medicine. But the thing that struck me, aside from the obvious political economic question, like, okay, you've just had your kidney stones crushed by, by Dr. Crusher. What do you pay? How do you pay? But it's the issue of sort of disjunction between Mesopotamian medicine and Greek medicine, and also Egyptian medicine, because as we all know, Mesopotamian medicine was basically based on herbs and spices and demons, and expunging the demons, possibly with some herbs and spices,
Right.
but not a lot more than that,
There was
really.
surgery in Mesopotamia.
Well, okay,
The
but
Hammurabi's laws, the doctor who tries to fix your eye, but you lose your eye, the eye gets couched out.
Dr. Mo.
Mistakes were made.
Right.
Right, but there are lots and lots of medical texts,
Yeah.
but they're
Right. But they're
mostly
all kind of what you were
magical,
explaining,
mystical. Apply
Alex.
a poultice and
Right.
take this herbal concoction, which may do something, but it's a
Yeah.
lot of it comes down to
But the Egyptians were doing operations.
Egyptians were doing a lot, and they have all these medical
And
texts.
they were drilling into skulls.
Right.
And they were, setting bones and things like that.
Right, and doing surgery, and a lot of it was sort of trauma based. And
For everybody.
right, well,
First and foremost.
I
Oh,
was
holy cow,
reading the
what is that?
I was reading the Edwin Smith Papyrus last night from the late
Oh,
Bronze Age,
yeah.
which
A
is about
suitable
two
bedtime
thirds
reading for anyone.
head wounds.
Oh,
But there's a lot of head wounds in gynecology, which I guess, sex division of some kind. But there's a lot of empirical observation. And they knew that, blood circulated in some fashion,
right.
and that's all, very, they knew a lot.
Right. Well, I
They
guess
knew all
let me
these
think.
guys, they knew a lot.
Yeah, and I think I was also going backwards instead of forwards, Rachel. And I was also thinking about, yeah, what is the link between, I was just thinking Egyptian because
Right,
I think
right.
there's more information on it. And I sort of thought, huh, I wonder, right, so the Greeks pick up the whole thread, and we know about medical texts from Egypt to Mesopotamia. And I was thinking that a key linkage point is the Persian period. And that's where I really stopped. I didn't do any research, but I'm wondering if there are Persian medical texts or, you know, medical texts from the Achaemenid period in whatever language, there's
Right. That's
number of
interesting.
languages.
Right.
And what are the Persians doing about it? And, you know, that also, because of the very close ties between religion, and in the case of this Roman example, it's, you know, pagan religion and Asclepius. And there was a temple to Asclepius in Pergamon, so, you know, this
Right.
that is close by, but not right there. So what might be the connection between Zoroastrianism and medical texts and medical practice, and, you know, does blood flow in their tradition, and all these kinds of things?
Yeah, no,
But
that's
that's,
very
I didn't
interesting.
get any further than that.
That's like the missing link, at least
Right.
chronologically, between Mesopotamia and Egypt and
And
Greece.
also the potential vector between getting, you know, between this Egyptian medical information and Greek and Roman practice.
Yeah. I mean, it is fascinating how much they knew and how much they were willing to try. And I think
Well.
just stand still for a minute. Just gonna try this. I'm just gonna try this. No, it's fine. Yes.
Drink this. Let's see if it expunges the demon. There's a
yeah.
lot of room for experimentation in antiquity.
Yeah.
You got no medical malpractice insurance. You have no state regulators that we know of.
Well, we don't know that,
You
but
know, that we know of.
nobody's got, like you said, Alex, nobody's going to do this unless, no one's going to submit to this unless they're in extreme pain. And yeah, it's not like this is, selective or elective rather, surgery. No one's going to do that, I
I
hope.
also thought it was interesting how they talked about this as being potentially a group of doctors. So either a group practice or facilities in which lots of doctors came and went
Yeah.
and all operated independently.
It's like
And
Rampart General
right.
or
And
St. Elsewhere.
I thought that that was interesting in that we sort of then have a model of lots of doctors practicing together for either as a group or competing, but sharing all of the very expensive, no doubt, expensive instruments and, you know, the need for space, and all of that. And then how in the West over time it got atomized to the individual doctor, that you would go to the individual doctor. And now that model obviously is out and everything is once again at the group level because of the expense and litigious nature. And Rachel, you brought up, you know, a good point about Hammurabi's code, that there are all these laws. So litigious activity with the medical arts is also very ancient. It's
Yeah,
nothing new.
that's a good point too.
But
Yeah.
that also raises the question of how you, I mean, never mind how you train doctors, but how do you police and regulate them in any of these periods? Okay, let's assume that they're going to be sued on the basis of Hammurabi. You know, that speaks to state, to not state, you know, legal involvement. Legal and state are not necessarily the same thing, but okay. Is it caveat emptor? You know, or is it, what kind of recourse did you have? And it also speaks to the question of, well, what happens below the level of this HMO? And
Well, there are,
if you're 50 miles outside of Pergamon and you can't make it to the spa at the Magic Mountain,
yeah.
how is medicine being applied and practiced? And it really, that's a really question that, that applies everywhere in the ancient world outside of the range of the outside of the range of texts, let's say.
Right. Well, you have, I'm assuming, you should never assume, but I'm assuming you have medicine women on the very local level. Medicine.
Dr. Quinn.
Well, huh?
Dr. Quinn.
Dr. Quinn, right. And, you know, you have every town has its person who you go to, and it's only either people in cities who have the HMOs available to them or...
Well, hold on. Let's stop using the term HMO because that's, you know, I know it's very snappy, but it has a whole set of, you know, implications and, you know, it's really, we have no idea of what it is, but yeah. It's certainly not an HMO. So that's
fair. Yeah.
Right. Because it is a big difference as to, because I think it's a very interesting model to suggest that they built this, you know, facility and then individuals, you know, signed up for hours when they had, you know, their availability as yeah. opposed to a group practice.
Yeah, no, I think you're
group
right.
Group practice takes a tremendous amount of, you know, sort of higher level organization, vision, and, you know, there's a whole implied hierarchy and how all of that works. That would be a lot.
Yeah.
And individuals saying, well, I can't afford the facility. I can't even afford the tools. So let's all pitch in and then operate independently. That also takes a certain amount of organization, but much less.
That's true. I'm picturing, you know, all these medical buildings with multiple doctor's offices, but the doctors have nothing to do with each other. That's probably closer to
right.
Well, that's something
right. But for the vast number of people in the villages, towns, and even in the cities, it's a local affair. Whatever medicine is very much a local affair. If you're in the Roman military, okay, then that's a much more organized affair, or right. any military. And there are Roman military hospitals that we know about. But you know, if you're kicked by a mule and you get dragged to, you know, a village, who's gonna treat you? And on what basis of knowledge are they going to treat you? Mm. And a lot of that seems to be below the level of our archaeological and textual historical perspective. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's all, you know, shamans and priests and things, but...
No, it means it's barbers.
Barbers.
Yeah.
Right? So the whole medieval world is being treated, or the majority of the medieval world and early modern world in the West, at least West, is being treated by barbers.
Theodoric, Barber of York.
Right, who have various abilities and skills and everything else. So I don't think it would be much different. You get dry, you know, something happens to you, you get brought to a village, and it's like, well, who wants to take a crack at them?
Yeah.
Now, and you have some people who have shamanistic practices, and you have other people who can sew, and you have other people who, you know, are more than willing to you know, dive in with their hands, and other people who shun all of that. I don't think it's going to go much beyond, you know, whoever feels that they can help.
Yeah.
It takes a village.
I'm right. It takes a village to kill a person who's been kicked by a mule.
Right.
And but then you get into the cities, or not even in the cities. I mean, the Roman period, as you know, from my perspective, is always pretty modern. So, you know, this isn't a city, but it's adjacent to a city. But clearly, you know, the medical arts have saturated the core area of the Roman Empire, right? You're not in Libya or anything, which is even parts of Libya are core, but... You know, I think in the core area, the medical arts are being practiced with some degree of, you know, a strong presence.
Yeah, yeah. And frankly, right, if you're kicked by a mule somewhere in a rural countryside, you're probably not going to survive the trip to the bigger city. So
right.
You get a disease by the time you decide, oh, this is serious. Oh, I might need to see somebody in the big city. It's too late.
Right.
Right. And but parallel to this, we
He's
do
not giving up.
we do know
building
know
some
from
kind of systemic infrastructure.
I know, but we know from human remains from lots of periods and lots of places that you know people did survive with possibly worse for the wear, but their abscessed teeth were wired together with gold wires, and their broken bones were managed to heal, and they survived trepanation.
Yeah.
Of all things. And
don't you think it was all pretty ad hoc? I mean, right, all of the early trepanations, these are happening in, very strange and somewhat isolated kinds of places. So I assume it was all pretty ad hoc.
Yeah.
I suppose, but I mean, trepanation is sort of an extreme example.
Well, it isn't, because there's no pain involved.
Oh, that's okay. A lot of these things are extreme examples.
But where do you get the idea? I mean, does the idea for sawing somebody's skull open
or drilling
come from, is it exchanged in Neolithic knowledge networks the way that, you can, here's a domesticated sheep. Oh, here's how to chip a stone tool. Oh, here's, did you know that you can saw somebody's head open?
Right.
It's just like a package of knowledge.
Yeah, here's how you shuck an oyster, and here's how you drill into a skull. It's all in the back of the matchbook.
I guess. It's but who's the first person who does that? I'll do it.
Who's the first person who ate a raw oyster?
It's quite compelling.
Yeah, those are good questions. And it is interesting that a lot of our earliest knowledge about surgery is trepanation.
Yeah.
And that always to me suggests that whoever they were operating on felt like they probably had, demons inside of them.
Right.
And it was related to, a whole sort of religious purview or cultic or whatever, or epiphenomenal. And that they had to get, it was so extreme, they had to get this stuff out.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, but on the other hand, the guy who's, and I use that gender neutral, the person who was drilling could have been, the person who was napping Flint and, right. was very handy.
Right.
Takes a lot of confidence. Cool. Oh yeah, I got this.
Yeah, exactly. How different can it be from, butchering a cow?
Right. Well, it takes confidence to be a surgeon today, I would assume.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So I think that's...
Well, I mean, and in the earlier, I mean, they have obviously immense familiarity with animals and with human bodies, because in the earliest periods, they're disassembling these things like Legos.
Right. And when they're burying them, they're, they're gaining familiarity.
Yeah.
And especially if they're secondary burials, they're probably figuring out the basic anatomy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all true.
Right. And by the Roman period, there is a real body of knowledge, let's call it.
And this, you're right, Galen produced a text on it.
Yeah. Right. And there's a lot of guys who, and the Egyptian, by the second millennium in Egypt. Yeah. There's a real body of knowledge. And so you could expect, if you got kicked by a mule, maybe the person who treated you has been exposed to this body of knowledge in some way. Yeah. Well, germs, though.
Well, that there wasn't a body of knowledge about.
Yeah, that's pity. Actually. But all right, final thoughts?
Final thoughts.
All right. So I'm amazed by how much they knew, and how it was probably passed down and improved generation by generation. Even though I don't like thinking about the squeamish nature of this,
But maybe the squeamishness is just your presentist bias.
That could be, absolutely.
I don't know. Isn't pain pain?
Well, pain is pain, but.
But disgust is not pain.
No.
Right. Well, but no, again, to be willing to be operated on means you're in terrible pain to begin with.
Right.
Or you think you have demons or both.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't really want to contemplate the cataract surgery.
Oh,
no.
Well, I don't really want to contemplate the kidney stones either.
Yeah, well, that's a little easier to visualize.
Yeah, the cataract surgery.
Choking.
Because.
Because you're not going to be able to get
the cataract. I can't imagine opting for that. I would just prefer to be blind.
Which you might end up with anyway, because can they actually separate the cataract from the lens, or they're just going to take the lens?
We know nothing about all of this.
Yeah. And then they're going to just pack it with honey and mustard or something.
No, I think you're thinking pretzels, but yeah.
Yeah. Any other final thoughts?
No.
I guess we can all go off to lunch now, if possible.
Yeah.
Well, after this episode, all I can say is take 2 aspirins and call us in the morning. But before that, we'd like to thank our music director, Maestro Erez Dessel, for our theme music. Look for his performances in the Chicago area and beyond. Follow him and his music on Instagram at 54BPM. We'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Dumont Television Network, a division of Yoyodyne Propulsion Systems. Be sure to catch For Doctors Only, Tuesday mornings at 8. Now, to get in touch, leave us a comment or hit the little heart-shaped button, because hearts mean love. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at This Ancient and on Facebook. Contact us via email at thisweekintheancientneareast, it's all one word, @gmail.com, or send us a postcard at P.O. Box 1177, Boston, Mass. 02134.